existing potential to expand cooperation with Tehran. The Iranian top diplomat is also scheduled to meet with other senior Azerbaijani officials. While Israeli forces continue to kill and injure Palestinian civilians across the Gaza Strip, more than 2 months after the ceasefire agreement with Hamas entered into force, Israeli forces continued their violations of the ceasefire agreement on Sunday, launching attacks on the southern and central parts of the territory. Gaza's medical sources reported at least 6 new fatalities and 17 injuries within 24 hours. The fatalities included a Palestinian child who was killed by Israeli forces' gunfire in the El Mawasi area of Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. Another child was injured by Israeli gunfire in the El Tufah neighborhood of Gaza City. More than 370 civilians have been killed since the ceasefire took effect in October. The death toll from the Israeli genocide since October 2023 has risen to 70,360, leaving more than 171,000 others injured. Israeli forces also demolished buildings and opened fire in areas where they remain stationed east of Khan Yunis, as the regime's artillery shelled areas north of Rafah, also in southern Gaza. Well, now joining us from Deir al-Balah with the latest is our correspondent Ghada Ibrahim. Ghada, thank you very much, as always, for joining us during this hour's top headlines. Ghada, as we continue to say, the death toll continues to rise. Children, women, elderly usually make up the majority of this. And also, as we are accustomed to, unfortunately, that when the Zionist entity kills some of these people, they do actually take their bodies, their remains, in a way to pressure the family, to further torture them. How is all the situation happening there, in addition, of course, to the dire humanitarian situation, Khada?
Yes, exactly. The Gaza Health Ministry announced that at least 373 Palestinians were killed since the beginning of this U.S. brokered ceasefire agreement here in Gaza City, in different attacks on the areas not only behind the so-called yellow line, but also in areas outside the so-called yellow line zones. So more attacks are taking place until this moment. More attacks are taking place on the eastern parts of Khan Yunis City in particular, and the focal points of these attacks are happening to be behind the so-called yellow line in the eastern parts of Rafah City, the eastern parts of Khan Yunis, like Al-Qarara, Bani Sahela, and Abasan areas, and also on the eastern parts of Gaza City, Al-Sha'af neighborhood, and also Jabalia and Beit Lahia towns. These attacks are fatal, actually, and they are actually causing more victims among the Palestinians and among the devastated population here in the Gaza Strip, and the majority of these casualties are children and women. The latest of these attacks resulted in one Palestinian child killed that was in Al-Mawasi area near Rafah City, and another woman was also killed as a result of a previous attack after succumbing to her injuries, to the injuries she sustained previously from the eastern parts of Khan Yunis City as well. So every passing day, more people are falling victim to these attacks. More Palestinians are falling victim, not only in as martyrs, but also as injuries. More than 970 people were injured since the beginning of the ceasefire agreement, and the hospitals in Gaza City and also here in the middle area are still overwhelmed by the sheer volume of the casualties and by the sheer volume of the injuries that are coming to the hospitals from the different areas of the Gaza Strip, and particularly from the eastern parts of Gaza City and the eastern parts of Deir al-Balah, the eastern parts of Khan Yunis City as well. So amidst the shortages that the hospitals are experiencing regarding the shortages on fuel, the shortages in medications, medical supplies, they are still overwhelmed by the casualties resulted from the Israeli attacks. So according to the health ministry as well, at least 70 Palestinian children were killed since the beginning of the ceasefire agreement until now. At least one quarter of the casualties were actually women as well. So we are talking about an indiscriminate attacks that are targeting the Palestinians in all the areas of their displacement encampments or behind the so-called yellow line. In the western parts of the city, the Israeli occupation regimes or the Israeli occupation army's attacks are continuous, as well as more attacks are taking place in the western parts of Al-Mawasi area, like from the Israeli warships that are continuously attacking the people who are taking shelter in the western parts of Gaza City and the western parts of Al-Mawasi area. This is worth mentioning that these people are living unimaginable humanitarian crisis as a result of lacking all the basics of survival. They are lacking food, they are lacking sheltering materials, and as the cold weather sits in nowadays, their suffering is multiplied because they are lacking the food items, and most importantly, they are lacking the sheltering materials. And this is the third winter after the genocidal war started, and the situation is only deteriorating for them, and it is not getting any better, contrary to their expectations that the ceasefire would bring them the relief they wanted and the relief they have been waiting for since the beginning of the Israeli genocide.
Well, exactly. On that point, as always, I'd like to thank you very much there. Correspondent Ghad Ibrahim joining us from Deir al-Balah. Please stay safe and stay warm. The International Committee of the Red Cross says Israel continues to prevent its teams from visiting Palestinian prisoners, despite growing reports about their deteriorating health conditions. The Red Cross said its teams have been unable to visit Palestinian prisoners in Israel's jails since the Gaza genocide began in October 2023. The Red Cross said it is working to intensify efforts to reach detainees despite the restrictions placed on its operations. Earlier, the Palestinian Commission of Detainees and Ex-Detainees Affairs warned of the critical health conditions of Palestinians held in Israeli jails. Even Israel's own media have corroborated these reports. The Times of Israel has reported severe weight loss, clear signs of malnutrition, and overcrowding in the regime's jails. It also confirmed repeated physical abuse of Palestinians by prison guards. More than 9,300 Palestinians are currently imprisoned by Israel, including women and children. Reports say detainees face torture, abuse, malnutrition, and medical neglect, resulting in the deaths of dozens. Robert Inlakish says conditions for Palestinian abductees, particularly in the occupied West Bank, have worsened since October 2023. Let's hear more.
It's a problem, particularly in the West Bank, which has afflicted a large portion of the male population in specific. But when we're looking at post-October 7, 2023, those conditions have gotten much worse. We're looking now at a situation where these prisoners have been starved, beaten routinely, sexually assaulted, subjected to all sorts of forms of rape, gang rape, rape with sticks, the use of dogs to do as such to them. So we're looking at very, very extreme cases. And there's around roughly still 11,000 Palestinians who are held by the Israelis in both prison and then as well military detention camps. And the two are actually different. One is the Israeli military system and military courts, which either produces these administrative detainee orders, which is held without a charge orders, or it eventually convicts Palestinians in its kangaroo court system that has a 99.9% conviction rate. But the others are those who were kidnapped and held hostage from Gaza. And these prisoners, or these hostages, are being subjected to some of the worst forms of torture imaginable.
Well, the UN Special Rapporteur on the occupied Palestinian territory has praised a growing European boycott of the Eurovision Song Contest over Israel's presence in the competition. Francesca Albanese called it a sign of shifting public conscience following a long time inaction on the regime's crimes. In a social media post, Albanese lamented that Israel has not been suspended from the UN and other international forums, as well as UEFA, FIFA, FIBA, or cultural events. She argued that the institutional silence on Israel's crimes has allowed the Gaza genocide to be normalized and continue unabated. Albanese was referring to a Eurovision boycott movement that has gained momentum in recent days. Slovenia, Spain, the Netherlands, and Ireland have already announced that they will not participate, citing the contest's failure to hold a vote on banning Israel. Iceland has also indicated that it will hold further discussions before a final decision. Israeli forces have conducted fresh raids into the Palestinian towns of Alal al-Balda in northern Tulkarm region in the occupied West Bank. Our correspondent Nakat Hamad joined us earlier from Ramallah with the latest updates on the ongoing Israeli atrocities across the occupied territory.
Palestinian, a 19 years old Mu'min Nidal Abu Riash, was announced martyred by the direct gunshots by the Israeli forces last night. The Israeli forces directly shot live ammunition against those three Palestinians, of course, under the pretense of performing a car ramming operation, which the cameras of the surveillance cameras have clearly denied and showed that the Israeli forces shot those three Palestinians without imposing any threat or danger towards the Israeli forces who were on the land of the village of Azzoun to the east of occupied Qalqilia. This is actually quite similar to what happened in Al-Khalil, where the Israeli forces also shot two Palestinians under the same pretense of performing a car ramming operation, but they were actually just in the street. One of them was a municipality worker who was just cleaning the street and that shot, and the other was a 17-year-old Palestinian child who was trying to reach towards his home. With this announcement of the martyrdom of Mu'min Abu Riash, the total number of the Palestinians killed in the occupied West Bank since October 2023 rises up to more than 1,089 Palestinians that have been killed in the occupied West Bank.
While calls grow for more countries to boycott the Eurovision Song Contest in opposition to Israel's inclusion in the competition. Ireland, Spain, the Netherlands, and Slovenia have already confirmed that they will not take part in the event next May. Jerome Hughes reports from Dublin.
It may be just a song contest, but analysts say this could be the moment that triggers long-awaited international pressure on the Israeli regime over its crimes against humanity. Because Israel will take part, Ireland will not participate in the 2026 Eurovision Song Contest next May. And state broadcaster RTE is also refusing to air the event.
This is great to see Ireland boycotting. And I wish to see my own home country, Norway, do this exactly same thing. We have been discussing the same topic as you guys in terms of boycotting this year's Eurovision if Israel's going to participate.
Ireland will not be a participant in next year's Eurovision Song Contest.
The same step has been taken by public broadcasters in Spain, the Netherlands and Slovenia, generating widespread international coverage. Campaigners say this alone is a major victory, but they insist pressure must now intensify on EU leaders to seize the moment and impose tough sanctions on Tel Aviv.
I am ashamed to be a European at the moment because the European Union is doing nothing at all. It's not doing nothing to stop the genocide, it's contributing to the genocide.
The European Broadcasting Union, which oversees Eurovision, moved swiftly to ban Russia, yet has taken no such action against Israel. Activists argue that if a major country like Germany were to withdraw, the message would be impossible to ignore. But they say Berlin is unlikely to act due to lingering guilt over World War II.
We are seeing a genocide, you know, in front of our eyes. So you can get away from this guilt feeling. And try to solve this problem.
For its part, Irish broadcaster RTE says it would be unconscionable for Ireland to be involved in the Eurovision Song Contest, given the appalling loss of life in Gaza and the humanitarian crisis there. While the decision by RTE has been broadly welcomed here in Ireland, pressure continues on the Irish government to cut all trade ties with Israel and also use its influence in Brussels to encourage other EU countries to do the same. Jerome Hughes at Government Buildings, Dublin.
In other news, Thailand's military has launched airstrikes along its disputed border with Cambodia after clashes that killed one Thai soldier and wounded four others. Thailand Army spokesman Major General Winhai Suvari has said country's aircraft targeted positions in Chongbuk area in northeastern Thailand following alleged Cambodian fire. He added that the military was expediting evacuation support for civilians in border areas. Meanwhile, Cambodia's defense ministry confirmed the raids in two provinces, saying it had not retaliated. The incident is the latest flare-up since a July ceasefire that ended 5 days of fighting, which left 48 people dead and displaced 300,000 others. Tensions have persisted amid long-standing disputes over the 817-kilometer frontier. Well, thank you very much, everyone. Please stay tuned. Goodbye for now.
today's special.
Assalamu alaikum.
It's special for you. We present to you today. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salam alaikum, dear brother and sister. Welcome. This is today's special from IRIB English Radio. Thank you very much for choosing this program to listen to, where we're going to speak about living a blessed life.
Life is not the same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I wanna have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know that amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. You are the light who guides me through my darkest nights, shows me right from wrong. In a world that often lies, cause I don't need anyone, anything in life, but you know I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
Today's Monday, 17th of Jamadi Uthani, 1447 of the Islamic Lunar History Calendar. Corresponding to the 17th of the month of Azar, 1404 of the solar calendar, and the 8th of November, 2025 of the Christian Gregorian calendar. This is chapter An-Nisa, verse 81. We'll listen to it, we'll come back to the studio and speak about the meaning of this verse.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. ويقولون طاعة فإذا برزوا من عندك بيت طائفة منهم غير الذي تقول والله يكتب ما يبيتون فأعرض عنهم وتوكل على الله وَكَفَى بِاللَّهِ وَكِيلًا.
And they say, we pledge obedience. But when they leave you, a group of them spend the night determining to do other than what you say. But Allah records what they plan by night. So leave them alone and rely upon Allah. And sufficient is Allah as disposer of affairs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha.
Bless your day with contemplation on the verses of the Holy Quran.
In this verse, the Quran has pointed to the situation of some hypocrites. It says that when they come beside the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his pure progeny, they harmonize with others and express that they obey the command of the Holy Prophet. But when go out from the presence of the Prophet, they neglect their promises, and in their night meetings, they make some decisions against the Holy Prophet. Yet Allah commands His Messenger to turn aside from them with no fear. He's ordered not to rely on them in His affairs, but to trust only in Allah, who is the best assisting helper and protector.
Shukran ya Rabbi, shukran.
شكرًا يا ربي شكرًا هديت قلبي شكرًا نورت دربي شكرًا شكرًا يا رب يا منزل القرآن يا خالق الإنسان يا ربي يا رحمن شكرًا يا.
We're going to speak about living a blessed life. How often has a long life brought about so little And how often has a short life brought about so much? If someone's life is blessed, he will attain in short time bounties from Allah that cannot be expressed in words or comprehended in descriptions. In Islamic terminology, there is a lot of attention given to what is called barakah or blessing. Blessing is denied as the divine good displayed in something. When we invoke Allah's blessings in something, this means that we would have favorable results due to the divine blessing.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Dear brothers and sisters, today we have another topic to discuss about. If life is a blessing, are we looking at the life as a blessing? So let's have a look at the Quranic perspective of the meaning of life, or what life is, if it is a blessing or not. In the Holy Quran, the word life or hayat is used 76 times. The concept of life in the Quran includes all living beings. In 5 verses of the Holy Quran, that term hay, or living, is attributed to Allah himself as well. The word life is used in various ways in the Quran. Some of its usages correspond to the literal meaning of the world of the word, such as mahyai, or my life, or ahya, that is the living, and other forms of this word. Sometimes the word is used metaphorically, such as attributing life to dead earth, which means the growth of plants in the earth. Furthermore, in some verses, the Quran corrects people's views about life by presenting new dimensions and deepening the concept of life as a divine blessing. Thus, in the Holy Quran, life encompasses more than just physical movement and daily activities. It includes, for example, in Surah Al-An'am, verse 122, and Surah Al-Anfal, verse 24, that following the truth and believing in Allah is a life-giving factor, leading to guidance, making one alive. While disbelief is considered death. For this reason, in Surah Al-Fatir, verse 22, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala refers to believers as living, that is ahya, and the disbelievers to the dead, that is al-amwat.
Special topics for a special program. You can listen today, now and here, IRIB English Radio.
May this moment last forever in your hearts, a day you'll always remember every bar.
Today's a special.
This feeling of love, just let it grow forever through your life. Bring beautiful years of joy between you till the end of time.
Now, how we can attain the good life and blessed one? Spending time in isolation with Allah can be one way. Of course, it's a part of the way. This includes reciting the Quran with reflection, or tadabbur, dhikr, or supplication with reflection, or tafakkur, talking to Him, to Allah, intimately in heartfelt or dua, and combining all in salah or prayer with humility and full focus. This has a deep impact on strengthening our connection with Allah and increasing the love for Him. Indeed, the beloved of Allah are those who have inherited the good life and tasted its bliss due to conversing privately with the Lord and experiencing the sweetness of His life in their heart.
Thank you.
were speaking about barakah or blessed life. So what actions increase barakah in our life? Barakah in time means having the same 24 hours in a day as everyone else, but being able to get more out of it. In era of productivity hacks, shortcuts, and instant gratification, the believer seeks barakah in time in order to get more out of life, even if one's lifespan itself is shorter than average. For students, barakah in time is the ability to get more studying done with less time. For professionals, it is the ability to fulfill one's work responsibilities while having the time to excel and do more. For parents, it is the experience of raising one's children with more benefit in their overall development. Some scholars had so much barakah in their time. It's as though they finish in a day what it would take others a week to accomplish. One way to seek more barakah in time is to sincerely ask Allah for it consistently and to use one's time wisely. A second way to seek barakah in time is to specifically utilize the morning time.
Recent studies have explored how gratitude relates to meaning in life throughout adulthood. Findings suggest that individuals who habitually experience gratitude also report a stronger sense that their lives are coherent, purposeful, and significant. This holds across different ages, indicating that gratitude may be a resource for existential well-being in both youth and later life. So all in all, if life is seen as a blessing, many traditions insist that it is also a trust that comes with responsibilities. This can be understood on several levels: caring for one's own health and mind, nurturing family and friendships, working honestly, and contributing to the common good. The blessing of life includes talents, opportunities, and time, all of which can be used wisely or wasted. Thinking of life as entrusted rather than owned outright can change attitudes towards decisions like self-harm, reckless behavior, or neglect of others. It suggests that people are stewards rather than absolute masters of their lives, accountable to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, to conscience, or to the moral community for how they use what they have been given. This stewardship perspective links personal spirituality with social ethics.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of today's special, which in that way speak about a blessed life and the ways, of course. Follow us. Thank you, and fi amanillah.
La ilaha illallah, Allahu Rabbi, Muhammad Nabi, Aliyul Imami, Lafata illa Ali, Aliyul Imami, علي إمامي علي إمامي
لا إله إلا الله الله ربي
محمد نبي علي إمامي
لا فتى إلا علي علي إمامي علي إمامي علي إمامي
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we provide an in-depth analysis of the Zionist entity's criminal behaviour and the effort it puts into influencing international policymakers and global public opinion. In today's show, we'll be looking at Jeffrey Epstein's role in trying to damage the reputations of two esteemed academics, John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt. This was after they wrote a book about the pro-Israel lobby's disproportionate influence over US foreign policy. In our first report, Latif Arabachakra describes how Epstein, who was a Zionist asset, and the notorious Zionist lawyer, Alan Dershowitz, invented allegations of anti-Semitism against Mearsheimer and Walt.
Recently released emails of Jeffrey Epstein contain evidence that the convicted paedophile and Zionist intelligence agent collaborated with Harvard Law professor Alan Dershowitz to discredit the landmark 2006 study by Mearsheimer and Walt titled The Israel Lobby. During the first week of April 2006, Epstein received multiple early drafts of an attack piece by Dershowitz titled Debunking the Newest and Oldest Jewish Conspiracy. Dershowitz, who also served as Epstein's defense lawyer, accused Mearsheimer and Walt of recycling discredited trash from neo-Nazi and so-called Islamist websites, accusing them of authoring a modern counterpart to the protocols of the Elders of Zion. Epstein responded to Dershowitz's email, "Terrific. Congratulations." Later, Epstein received another message from Dershowitz's email address asking Epstein to help circulate copies of the attack. Epstein replied in the affirmative, "Yes, I've started." While Mearsheimer has spent his entire career at Chicago, his co-author Stephen Walt has been professor of international relations at the Harvard Kennedy School since 1999. Epstein was a powerful figure at Harvard. He had spent years cultivating relationships at the university, donating more than $9 million between 1998 and 2008. He positioned himself as a fixer and patron for high-profile academics, including Dershowitz and economist Larry Summers, who was the president of Harvard at the time and recently apologized for his connections to Epstein. At the time, Epstein served as trustee and president of the Family Financial Office of Jewish billionaire Leslie Wexner. It donated nearly $20 million to the Kennedy School between 2000 and 2006. The Wexner Foundation's contributions underwrote core operating expenses. The foundation also funded a visiting scholar program, which allowed 10 Zionist regime officials to attend the Kennedy School each year for a one-year master's degree. Wexner is one of the most influential supporters of the Zionist colony. In 1991, he co-founded a philanthropic organization of Jewish billionaires known as the Mega Group, which uses some of its vast resources to support the genocidal colony. It reportedly had contacts with the Mossad and served as a vehicle for influence operations in the United States. Among its operations, it supported the creation of the Racist Birthright Israel program and the renewal of Hillel International, the Zionist student group, which now has over 1,000 branches, including 50 outside of the US. In other words, Epstein's collaboration with Dershowitz connects the big players of the Israel lobby to attacks on the idea that there was a powerful Israel lobby. Walt, who still works at Harvard, declined to comment on these allegations. Mearsheimer said, "I'm not surprised to see these emails, because Dershowitz and Epstein were close, and both have a passionate attachment to Israel."
As usual, I'm joined in the studio by David Miller, who's the UK's foremost scholarly critic of Israel and our resident expert. He's a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch and a senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyim University. Our guest contributor today is the Palestinian author, poet, activist and political commentator Susan Abulhawa. Her first novel, Mornings in Jenin, was an international bestseller that was translated into 30 languages. Her other books include The Blue Between Sky and Water and Against the Loveless World. She also founded Playgrounds for Palestine in 2001 that upholds the right to play for Palestinian children. Welcome to the show. David, these emails from Jeffrey Epstein, I mean, they've seemed to be throwing up quite a lot of intriguing stories, haven't they?
Yeah, I mean, there have been a lot of stories. I mean, we're discussing the attack on the Israel lobby this week, but there are many other stories about Epstein's role in geopolitics, essentially, in Côte d'Ivoire, in Africa, in Far East Asia, all sorts of involvement, of course, in line with Zionist intelligence aims and strategies, but much wider direct involvement than people have previously thought. Now, in relation to the Israel lobby thing, this is an indication, isn't it, that underlying the idea that Israel is only just an instrument of US imperialism is actually the Israel lobby saying, oh, it's not the Israel lobby. And that's the new thing about this particular story.
Yeah, is this just sort of a damage limitation exercise that they're going through?
Well, it's like, don't look at us, look elsewhere. And of course that helps. The left helped them with that by saying, oh, well, it's US imperialism, we shouldn't be looking at Zionists, and we shouldn't use the word Zionist. So it's part of that kind of area of ideas, but it does indicate that many people on the left are effectively spouting Zionist talking points.
Yeah, kind of acting as sort of useful idiots, almost, you might say. But Susan, I mean, do you think we're beginning to get a better picture of the role that was actually played by Epstein?
Yeah, for sure. Epstein's operation is not likely to be the only one of its kind also. Zionists have used sexual coercion and sexual blackmail since before Israel was formally established, even. And this is well known and documented, especially against Palestinians, but also against British officials during the mandate period. There's a book by Daniel Halper that credibly suggested that the Monica Lewinsky tapes were used to blackmail Bill Clinton in the 90s. Israel has used honey trap operations like this to kidnap Mordecai Vanunu, for example, the man who famously blew the whistle on Israel's nuclear program. And so Israel has a long history of these tactics, and Epstein's operation is par for the course, and it's not likely to be the only one. And the second thing to know about Epstein's operation is that it was never meant to be seen, rather, in the light of scrutiny. These tactics are meant to remain in the shadows, controlling politicians, policy, and so on, beyond public view. And the fact that this story is in the public consciousness now is an aberration of how things typically work with Zionist influence. What I can say with some certainty is that what we know, namely what has been released, is the tip of the iceberg. So in addition to focusing on what these emails reveal, I think we should also focus on what has been kept hidden. Because ultimately, the declassification of the current documents was meant solely to quell public outrage. It was never meant to inform or even reveal. So what we don't see, I believe, is far more important for transparency, and people should not stop demanding the full disclosure of everything that they seized from and surrounding the Epstein pedophile operation.
Well, David, I mean, what about Epstein assisting Dershowitz then with his attack on the book that was written by John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt?
Well, I mean, Dershowitz, of course, is famously this rabid pro-Zionist law professor at Harvard. He's also, of course, also Epstein's defense lawyer in the allegations of sexual abuse and trafficking against him. He also was accused, and then some of the accusations were resiled from, of himself being involved in rape and sexual abuse. So that there's all of that. And also the emails recently released have shown Epstein, looking down his nose at Dershowitz, saying this man's crazy, of his own defense lawyer. So you can see the kind of internecine nest of vipers that these people were operating in, at the same time as helping each other with their strategies. And Epstein, in this case, helping to spread the word about Dershowitz's ridiculous attempted hatchet job on the Israel lobby.
Yeah, indeed. And I've seen Dershowitz slightly embarrassed, I think, about his relationship with Epstein. I think it was Max Blumenthal who challenged about that, and he sort of made the I'm just his lawyer. I was just his representative.
Well, that's what everyone who was associated with him tried to say, wasn't it? Ehud Barak, the former Prime Minister of Israel. Yeah. Prince Andrew, not called Prince Andrew anymore, and Larry Summers, of course. The president of Harvard, who's now apologised and says he's going to step back because recent emails have shown indeed that he was very close.
What's your take on Dershowitz in general? I mean, as we were just saying, I mean, he was Epstein's defence lawyer as well, wasn't he?
Dershowitz is a truly unsavory character, and that's being very generous. I actually debated him in 2010 at a literature festival in Boston because he had written a novel, if you can even call it that. It was a very badly written monument to his ego. but yes, as you say, he was indeed Epstein's lawyer, but their relationship doesn't appear to have been purely professional. It seems they were friends, perhaps good friends. Dershowitz attended his parties. He went to his island, Epstein's island, and he traveled on Epstein's Lolita plane. And let's not forget, too, that Dershowitz himself was accused by multiple women of sexual assault and sexual abuse. So there was a connection between the two men that went beyond him just being Epstein's lawyer. And also, Dershowitz is the man who managed the plea deal with the then Florida's district attorney, Alexander Acosta, who oversaw that non-prosecution agreement that truly shocked everyone.
David, would you say a bit more, will you, about this Wexner character then that Latifa mentioned in her report?
So Wexner, one of the, is it hundreds, many Jewish billionaire oligarchs in the US, as the film said, funded the Harvard Kennedy School, not just Harvard, but the Harvard Kennedy School where Walt continues to work, and a very big player in the way in which all this kind of Zionist money went into Harvard. Summers was the president, of course, and that was part of the deal too. And Epstein as well was involved with people at Harvard in all sorts of odd sort of transhumanist research, which has been revealed in recent years too. So, but Wexner had his foundation. The foundation was effectively run by Epstein. Epstein ran his office from a house belonging to Wexner in New York. So they're very, very close relationships. Mm. And they clearly were at the center of a network of Jewish billionaires and so-called philanthropists funding Zionist causes in the US and indeed in the colony.
Mm. It's a very intriguing set of connections there, isn't it? But Susan, Epstein appears to have been heavily embedded at Harvard as well, doesn't he?
He was indeed. Epstein made it a point to infiltrate and make himself indispensable, really, in every major arena of power, whether it was at Ivy League universities, elite scientific circles, politicians, of course, heads of state, princes, kings, CEOs, and so on. And herein lies the information we really should try to get and not stop until we have full disclosure and a holistic picture of the full extent of this iceberg beneath the surface that we are really just glimpsing right now.
Well, our next report looks at who are the most influential Zionists in the United States.
It has been suggested that the emergence of these emails is ironic, since they tend to confirm the thesis of the 2006 Israel Lobby study, which was defined as a loose coalition of individuals and organizations that actively work to shape foreign policy. But do they? The mega group set up by Les Wexner, the former CEO of lingerie chain Victoria's Secret, was founded in 1991. And first publicized in 1998. It reportedly includes 50 or so billionaires or influential Zionist figures. These reportedly include Les Wexner, Charles and Edgar Bronfman, Charles Schusterman, Ronald Lauder, and Lawrence Tisch. These oligarchs and the involvement in the mega group of Jeffrey Epstein speak of Zionist manipulation and intrigue, but these are not central to the book. Only the Bronfmans appear fleetingly in the index. In the book itself, it is a narrowly defined Israel lobby which exercises influence. The top 10 most cited organizations in the book are, with one exception, all Israel lobby groups and not formally part of the Zionist movement. In order of citation, they are AIPAC, ADL, Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, YNAP, Zionist Organization of America, Israel Policy Forum, GENSA, and American Jewish Committee. ZOA is the exception. In addition, two of the four pillars of the Zionist movement are not in the index at all. These are the American Zionist Movement, the U.S. affiliated of the World Zionist Organization, and the Jewish National Fund, the U.S. affiliate of the Zionist Land Theft Agency. The book also entirely ignores the role of oligarchs, foundations, and intelligence-connected operators using blackmail and threats. It leaves out the role of Zionist intelligence agencies. There's no discussion of Unit 8200, the Signals intelligence agency, which has massively penetrated the tech and media industry. In the end, the book focuses almost entirely on the most visible elements of Zionist infiltration, but on neither the Zionist movement's great engine of radicalization, which turns out thousands of radicalized genocidaires in every generation, or the massive infiltration of Zionists throughout the administrative apparatus of the U.S. state.
Because 45 years ago, there was no Palestinian people.
Since at least the Reagan presidency in the 1980s. The involvement of Lawrence Tisch in the mega group is a further example of the relationship between Zionist oligarchs and Zionist infiltration. His granddaughter, Jessica Tisch, is a Zionist extremist who is the current commissioner of the NYPD. What does the Epstein-Dershowitz affair teach us? That Zionist radicalization and infiltration are much more serious and much less an informal and loose coalition than the Israel lobby thesis claims.
So, David, I mean, this mega group appears to be quite influential then, doesn't it?
Yeah, you heard some of the names there of some of the oligarchs who involve quite well-known names. That 50 or so names are people are supposed to be involved. Mm. We don't know the names of all of them, but amongst the others are other oligarchs, billionaires. The Bronfmans are interesting, as should be mentioned. The Bronfmans, of course, from the famous Canadian Zionist family who run the Seagrams, the distillers, and, of course, Wexner. They were at the top of this organization. Mm. Very, very influential, and really what it shows, I think, is the important role of billionaires and of the foundations, the family foundations that they set up in funding the whole Zionist movement, something which is not really referred to conceptually, at least, in the Israel lobby thesis. So I think that's an indication that actually, when you see something like the Mega Group, this shows that there is a much tighter grip on the Zionist coordination than you would think from the apparently loosely coordinated Israel lobby groups like the ADL or AIPAC or WNEP or or Jinsa, for example. So I think it's an indication, really, that the thesis, although people say it gives too much power to the Israel lobby, actually the thesis doesn't really understand the full way in which Zionists are able to exercise power in America.
Sure, right, okay. Well, Susan, I mean, you've been attacked and defamed by numerous Zionist groups, haven't you? In your opinion, how heavily embedded in US society are they?
Well, heavily embedded, I would say, in every aspect of US society, actually, in intelligentsia, in every branch of government, every major media outlet, Hollywood, every broadcast journalism, print journalism, media outlet, gaming industry, the AI industry, all the major tech industries, the national and global banking, universities, every branch of government, as I said. And the thing is, it's like there's, there's nothing wrong with people of various backgrounds. I mean, I don't having like overrepresentation in any field. There's nothing wrong with that. The problem it becomes when everything that they do is focused on nurturing and promulgating a settler colonial enterprise, and it becomes even treasonous in many instances. Also, I want to say. There's been some discussion about the Israel lobby, the book by Walt and Mearsheimer, but there were several books actually, I would say many that preceded this book, that go all the way back to the 70s. There was, for example, the late Congressman Paul Findlay, who served 22 years in Congress, wrote a book called "They Dare to Speak Out." After the lobby targeted him because he dared to suggest that maybe we should speak to the PLO.
Well, David, I mean, why do you think the Israel lobby has such a narrow definition of Zionist influence then?
Well, to some extent, it's quite understandable. I mean, Mearsheimer and Walt are not radicals. They're not left-wing political scientists. I mean, they're realist and, I suppose, centrist in U.S. terms, political scientists. And also, it was a taboo to even to mention the Israel lobby. And, of course, the massive attack that was on it from Dershowitz and Epstein and all the others indicates that even a minor critique, like or a milder critique, if you like, of the lobby, the Israel lobby groups, that caused howls of outrage from the Zionists. So that's part of the story. But I think also the problem is that there's no proper understanding or conceptualization about what Zionism is and how actually the Zionist movement is a fairly cohesive whole, much wider than just the question of the Israel lobby groups in the US or in the UK or indeed any other country. So there's a variety of reasons for this, and I think you've got to give all respect to Mearsheimer and Walt for doing the book in the first place, for advancing this thesis, because they've had all sorts of trouble from the right and from the Zionists as well as from the left. But then, nevertheless, we can go a lot further than that thesis went.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, sort of example, really, of the maximalist strategy that the Zionists always seem to employ, sort of backfiring. Maybe that's an issue we could perhaps return to in another show. But, Susan, I mean, some professed anti-Zionists are saying that Zionist infiltration in the West doesn't equate to Jewish supremacism. I mean, are they right or are they wrong, in your opinion?
As a Palestinian, I can tell you definitively that Zionism has always been a Jewish supremacist movement. At its core is a belief in Jewish entitlement, Jewish exceptionalism, and Jewish privilege at any cost, including genocide and destruction of other peoples who stand in their way, like Palestinians. If people feel uncomfortable with Jewish supremacism, I mean, it is what it is, but at a minimum, it is Jewish exceptionalism and Jewish entitlement.
Well, David, in our report mentioned the NYPD commissioner, what's her name, Jessica Tisch. I mean, can you say a bit more about her background?
Well, so she comes from this very famous Jewish oligarch family, the Tishes, right? And her